We're talking about our state's paper industry and what the future holds for a 100-year-old paper mill in Green Bay. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The paper industry employs more than 31,000 people, making Wisconsin the number one producer in the country. That's from the DNR. And a massive expansion for a paper mill in Green Bay had appeared to be moving ahead, but now its owner, Georgia-Pacific, says the project is on hold indefinitely. So what questions do you have about the paper industry in Green Bay? We're at 800-642-1234. Jeff Bollier is a reporter for USA Today Wisconsin Network. He's covering business in the Green Bay area. Jeff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me back.
So it appeared things were moving ahead for Georgia-Pacific on this expansion in Green Bay, but now that's on hold. What's going on there?
Yeah, there were some. It was a pretty eye-popping proposal that was submitted to city officials for consideration this week. It would have been a 450,000 square foot expansion to a 100-year-old mill that Georgia-Pacific owns on the south side of Green Bay.
So this is the Broadway mill we're talking about?
Yes, Broadway Mill. It was started in 1919, and I believe it was bought by Georgia-Pacific in 2000. So, and over that time, they've been making sort of periodic, significant improvements to the property and kind of adding production lines and changing things around. But this was going to be something of a pretty significant size in addition to all of those expansions.
How did this project come to light in the first place?
So they had submitted a request to the city of Green Bay to exceed height restrictions on a general industrial building. And so we of course, kind of caught wind of it at the USA Today Network and started asking a few questions. It came up that we were more in contention for it than it was a guarantee, but still was, you know, I kind of took it as a positive sign that there was a sort of second major paper expansion here in the paper industry expansion being considered here in the Green Bay area.
So what happens at the Broadway Mill? What is what type of paper mill is it?
It produces a lot of consumer products, paper towels, toilet paper. I wish I could tell you specifically, but I do not know that off the top of my head.
Well, let's take a call now. Jack in Caledonia. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Hey, question. With the hemp being able to grow again in Wisconsin and other states, does the paper does the timber industry feel threatened because the pulp is hemp makes a better paper product and better for recycling and things of that nature.
Do we know? Yeah, Jack, thanks so much. Do we know anything about how the hemp industry might collide with the paper industry?
I do not necessarily know how that will necessarily impact the sort of broader paper industry. I do know that that colleagues in the area have been working on stories about the growth of hemp production here in northeastern Wisconsin and across the state, but haven't really seen how the paper industry is really reacting to that, if they're sort of looking at hemp as another viable source of pulp for production of different paper products. But it definitely is a, Wisconsin is definitely sort of returning to its status as a leader in hemp production historically. So
we're looking at the pulp and paper industry in the Green Bay area with Jeff Bollier. He's a reporter for USA Today Wisconsin Network covering business there in Green Bay. Do you work for a mill? Have you heard anything about your company's future plans for expansion or contraction? How is the paper industry doing where you are? 800-642-1234. So, Jeff, getting back to the Broadway Mill in Green Bay, what other investments has Georgia-Pacific made to this mill in recent years?
Well, it has installed one natural gas burning boiler. That alone was about more than $20 million improvement, and they will be adding another one, another gas boiler, to replace a coal-fired boiler in the next year or so. Now, this will also facilitate removal of a couple of steam stacks on the site that are rather tall and pretty noticeable across the Green Bay area. They've added a towel line that cost about $7 million in improvements recently. They've added and expanded a bath tissue converting line and also made investments in sort of automated vehicles moving materials around the mill, as well as some other sort of infrastructure improvements over the years. But the company estimates it's more than $150 million in the last 5 years that it's invested in the mill.
So it seems like they are still pouring work into this mill to keep it up and running. The movement from coal-fired boilers to natural gas-fired boilers, is that significant in any way in how we how a paper mill functions?
It is not necessarily significant to how the paper still rolls off the line, but what it is important to, and we saw this in the Green Bay area also with Green Bay Packaging's major new mill construction project last year, is they're looking at trying to reduce emissions either into nearby streams and or into the air in terms of kind of what they emit. And so I can tell you that many of the paper companies up here are very aware of their sort of environmental impact and are looking for ways to reduce that. So might not necessarily make the paper move faster, but it does help in other ways, too.
Let's bring in Jack in Milwaukee now. Hi, Jack.
Hello. I just have a really quick question. My company is based out of Milwaukee, and we provide a lot of machinery for GP. I know we've in the past have made some of the stuff that's up there in Green Bay. So I'm pretty sure we had some contracts to produce more of this machinery. What happens now when, projects like this are put on hold?
Yeah, so Jack's company is a supplier to Georgia-Pacific for the machinery for these mills. What does it mean when, a deal like this goes south?
That is a very good question, and there certainly can be sort of residual impacts or ripples to this. The hope is that from talking to some economic development officials in the area that that this is just sort of while the company is saying it's put on hold indefinitely, that they will kind of revisit this in the near future, and maybe that the Green Bay mill will bump up the priority list, and therefore then Jack's company will be back into the order business or into business there. So,
well, in the last few seconds, a lot of people are looking for any indication on the overall health of the paper industry. Are there any bigger takeaways that you're seeing as we go forward?
I guess the takeaway I would say is that we've seen now two local paper companies, Green Bay Packaging last year and Georgia-Pacific this year, look at some pretty significant dollar investments in their operations here in the Green Bay area. So while there have been some issues with paper mills closing in the area and in the state, there are signs that some of the industry is seriously looking at the area to invest and grow.
Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a good conversation.
Jeff Bollier is a reporter for USA Today Wisconsin Network covering business in the Green Bay area. Up next, we discuss a recent push to repeal a nearly century-old law called the Jones Act. We'll talk about the law's significance to American shipbuilding. That's back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. On a Wednesday, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Summer is prime time to watch the massive ships go by on the Great Lakes. Now, back in late April, our show broadcast from Superior right around the time when the ice was breaking up in the Duluth Superior Harbor and maritime shipping season was just getting underway. And this is when you'll see those 1,000-foot freighters carrying their first cargo load of iron ore, coal, maybe grain. We toured a shipyard in Superior to take a closer look at what exactly goes on to ready these vessels for the water and what could compromise their operations. Here's producer Laura Pavin.
It's a crisp afternoon at Fraser Shipyards in Superior. James Farkas is president and CEO. He puts on a yellow construction hat and slides on a pair of clear safety glasses.
Just take a walk.
He rounds the corner, and there, towering 100 feet above the ground, is the Tim S. Duell. It's a freighting vessel that stretches the length of 2 football fields along the dock. It's named after a former president of the company that owns it, which means the stakes were high.
And I'm being facetious here, but Mrs. Duell grabbed me around her throat and said, "Don't let that vessel leave without it getting painted." And as you can see, it's painted.
It's a lacquered deep blue, with its name in bright white letters. Crew members wearing green construction hats mill around the vessel. They're doing maintenance in a dry dock before it hits the water. A pulley system of ropes and chains hangs around the boat's massive propeller. They're working on the propulsion system, and they're making sure that the Duell is structurally sound. Fraser Shipyards does a lot of maintenance. Building new ships, not so much.
Very, very infrequently do they build new vessels.
That's because the lifespan of ships that sail the Great Lakes is long, between 50 and 100 years. To get to the top of the ship, Farkas climbs a yellow metal ladder. It runs from the edge of the land, up across the dry dock far below, to the vessel's deck. The top is flat, and just feet away is a steep drop-off into a huge cavernous opening. At some point, the entire space will be full of material. What it's filled with, though, is still a question. Depends on market demands.
Yeah, we see taconite being pretty constant. Coal will continue to decline, in my humble opinion.
Taconite's where it's at.
Well, I guess so.
Taconite is low-grade iron ore that's melted down into steel. It's just one of the materials that travels through the Great Lakes ports each year. Below in the dry dock, materials are strewn about. Ropes, barrels, plastic tarps, and scrap metal. In the next couple days, crews will clean out the area and fill the dry dock with water. The ship will need a day or two to stabilize. After that, the vessel will float away. It takes dozens of people to ready the Tim S. Duell for its next journey. Farkas argues that maintenance work at the shipyard is strong because of the Jones Act.
It's a benefit to the families and people who work here and others around.
But Farkas has his eye on the Jones Act.
Well, there's some effort to roll it back.
And that was producer Laura Pavin in Superior. The Jones Act there, it is a federal law dating back almost a century. The law requires that all cargo carried between U.S. ports be transported on vessels that are built, owned, and operated by U.S. citizens. And the maritime industry is big business across the Great Lakes states. It generates billions in economic activity. Earlier this year, a Utah senator introduced a bill that would repeal the Jones Act. Do you work at a shipyard or in maritime shipping? How has the Jones Act affected your work? We're at 800-642-1234. Richard Stewart teaches transportation and logistics management and is director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center at UW-Superior. He's a former sea captain, and he joins us from our Superior studios this morning. Richard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Laura. Delight to be here.
So why should the Jones Act matter to people who aren't shipbuilders or working in shipyards?
Well, let's give a little historical perspective. The Jones Act was not the first cabotage law, Passenger Vessel Services Act, and we've actually had cabotage laws since the beginning of our Constitution. Cabotage is a French word in origin, and it means between the capes. And the idea is that transportation that occurs within domestic areas be controlled, regulated for safety, economic, and security reasons. Every mode of transportation in the United States has some form of cabotage law.
The Jones Act really has stood the test of time. For what purpose was it drawn up and passed in the first place, and how has it continued over almost a century?
When World War I started, America did not have a cabotage law for freight. Many of the ships that traded between Miami and New York, places like that, were owned by foreign companies. They immediately went to the war effort for the other foreign countries. Freight rates rose by 500% to transport cargo. The United States was unprepared. We didn't have shipyards. We didn't have skilled labor. When James Farkas talked about repairing or building ships, to create a naval architect or a shipwright takes years and years. You don't hire somebody off the street to build a ship. So we didn't have those resources. The U.S. government spent, by today's terms, billions of dollars to try and build a fleet of ships to supply for the war effort. And they resolved in 1920, when the Jones Act was passed, that they'll never be caught unprepared again. And when World War II came around, we were prepared, and places like Superior and Duluth turned out hundreds of ships in short order to serve the need of the merchant marine.
So what kind of impact today does the Jones Act have on these shipyards along the Great Lakes? What do you see?
Well, the Jones Act means that ships that operate in the domestic U.S. trade be built in the United States, crewed by American citizens, and managed by an American company. And that means we keep not only the ships here, but we keep the businesses headquartered in this area. So the Great Lakes fleets out of Duluth, we have other ones, American Steamship out of Buffalo. So it not only produces the ships, but the management skills in the area too. If we didn't have a Jones Act, some of our ships could be built overseas and brought here, and we would lose that shipbuilding expertise. The ships could be managed and operated by a foreign country with foreign personnel operating on them, and we would gain no tax revenue. We'd gain no management expertise. If you could imagine, and the airline industry has similar cabotage laws, if you could, the people want to overturn the Jones Act, say, well, it's much cheaper if I use a foreign ship built in Panama, crewed by Russians and operated out of Cyprus. And indeed, it probably would to run between Chicago and Duluth. You could do the same thing with an airplane, too, by the way. All modes of transportation limit for national security and defense and economic reasons. Who can operate within the borders of the United States?
Talking about the Jones Act and the impact it has on Great Lakes shipping with Richard Stewart. He is director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center at UW-Superior. Richard, what you just said there, the think tank, the Cato Institute, looks at the Jones Act as the reason why shipping costs are so high and why our shipbuilding industry is so diminished. What would you say to that?
Well, they're two separate items. Turning around, and if, let's assume we repealed the Jones Act. That does not mean we would suddenly have an influx of new shipbuilding and ship repair taking place. That wouldn't occur because that would move overseas and be done overseas. The Cato Institute, a number of other organizations over the years, as well as elected officials, have suggested that we do away with the Jones Act. Laws have come forward. The U.S. Navy has been opposed to it because they, speaking as a former naval captain, our job is to wage war at sea. It is not to carry cargo, and that's what merchant ships do. And in time of war, national emergency, we desperately need those merchant ships to carry the cargo. You can't do it on a destroyer. And so if all the ships were owned by foreign entities, we would basically have little or no control over those assets.
As we wrap up here, what do you see as the fate of the Jones Act? Where is this going?
Well, if the Cato Institute and other organizations believe that the fundamental underlying philosophy behind the Jones Act is incorrect, and you certainly could make an economic case that it's always cheaper to use the least expensive option in the marketplace, they should also be repealing the cabotage laws that prevent a Panamanian truck driver from running a truck that's owned and operated by a company overseas between Chicago and Duluth.
There are other ramifications.
Same thing with airlines. Yes.
And Richard, we have to end it there. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Richard Stewart teaches transportation and logistics management, director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center at UW-Superior, and he joined us from our Superior studio this morning. Coming up, we talk with an expert in drone technology to look at a report that the military is testing surveillance balloons over several Midwest states, including Wisconsin. That's after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about high-altitude balloon surveillance here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. military is doing what's called wide-area surveillance testing across six Midwest states, including parts of Wisconsin. And this is according to filings reported to the Federal Communications Commission and reported by The Guardian this month. Upwards of two dozen unmanned solar-powered balloons are being launched from rural South Dakota. They're carrying these high-tech radars, and they're drifting. They're drifting some 250 miles and landing in central Illinois. What do you think about the military testing surveillance technology over Wisconsin? How do you feel about the amount of surveillance technology in our communities and our skies? Join in at 800-642-1234. Arthur Holland Michel is co-director of the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College in New York. He's also the author of Eyes in the Sky, The Secret Rise of Gorgon Stare and How It Will Watch Us All. Arthur, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Great to be here.
Help us picture these balloons that the military is flying above the Midwest. What do they look like?
Well, they look a little bit like a giant, potty balloon. They're big, they're white, they fly at about 65,000 feet, so if you are hoping to spot one from the ground, you're kind of out of luck. And then hanging below the balloon is the sensor equipment, so that is the balloon's eyes, that is... It's a little short on details in terms of what equipment is actually on the balloons that will be tested. As far as we understand it, it's some kind of wide area radar system that points down at the ground and either collects very high resolution images of the topography or potentially detects any moving targets across a very wide area.
So why use these types of balloons for this surveillance rather than planes or unmanned drones?
Well, there are a few factors. As opposed to an aircraft, these balloons can fly for much longer periods of time. There's no need to land to refuel the aircraft or to relieve the crew. They can also fly at much higher altitudes than a lot of aircraft that are sort of generally available, meaning that you can cover a much wider area. Depending on where you are, you may also be outside of the reach of anti-aircraft defenses. Why you might use one instead of a drone, again, even drones that have the longest endurance can only stay up for maybe, if you're talking about the Department of Defense's drones, 30 hours, say, at a time, 36 hours. These balloons can fly for weeks. There may also be a cost differential there to take into account. But again, this is a very new technology for the Department of Defense, so I feel like at this point they're still sort of testing out what the cost-benefit analysis
right.
looks like compared to those other options.
When you say a cost differential, do you mean that these balloons could be less expensive for surveillance purposes?
Yeah, you're not going to have a lot of crew doing ground support, operating the aircraft. It's not like a drone that is piloted much like an inhabited airplane, where you have someone at the joystick controls at all times. And also, you know, the technology is inherently cheaper than, say, a very large, sophisticated drone as well.
So what types of things could be seen from these balloons? What would they be zeroing in on?
Well, you know, one of the main roles for the Department of Defense organization that's conducting these tests, the Southern Command, is monitoring borders and drug interdiction. That means you're looking at very, very wide areas to try and identify people who are, say, smuggling contraband across your area of interest. That means that you're going to want to detect anything that's moving within that area and then zoom in on it and see if you can identify it. That's why they are probably using a technology that's called Ground Moving Target Indicator, which will not give you a very detailed look at everything in the whole coverage area, but it will show you everything that is moving. So say you have a person crossing, a very remote border region. Nothing else in the area is moving at that same speed, and so that individual will light up. What it's not going to do is identify exactly what that person looks like, say, or if it's a vehicle, what the license plate is.
We're learning about balloon surveillance with Arthur Holland Michel. He's co-director of the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College in New York. What questions do you have about balloons or drone surveillance? How do you feel about this technology in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Bernie now in Elkhorn. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. Excellent topic. This is completely contrary to the Fourth Amendment. It's completely wrong for the military to be surveilling U.S. citizens, although we know from WikiLeaks publications that they've been doing it in other modalities for some time. And it's outrageous. And what's really sad, I think, is that our so-called representatives of both major parties will go along with this.
So where do people argue here our rights to privacy perhaps outweighing the potential benefits of surveillance, Arthur?
Well, you know, it's a very good point, and it actually indicates that perhaps we've reached a moment in time where our laws have fallen quite far behind the technology itself. Because believe it or not, using a military-grade camera to conduct surveillance of very wide areas of the United States from above is not illegal. In fact, if you do so for active law enforcement operations without a warrant, you're not breaking any laws because the air is considered private space. I mean public space, not private space. And anything that's seen from public space is fair game, as opposed to, say, entering someone's home, which under the Fourth Amendment you do need a warrant for. But, of course, that standard of what counts as public space versus private space was developed at a time when we didn't have giant autonomous balloons that fly at 65,000 feet recording our every move. So to me, that raises the question of whether it's time to perhaps reconsider whether indeed the technologies need to have new rules applied to them that sort of pull them out of that loophole that they're currently operating within. That being said, it's important to note that at the moment, these operations that we're talking about, the balloon operations, they are tests. What's concerning, though, is that data that's collected through a test, if it indicates some illegal activity, that's still going to be passed on to law enforcement. And there the lines get very blurry, especially if you're talking about technologies that don't require a warrant to be used.
Let's bring in Jacob now in Madison with thoughts on this. Good morning, Jacob.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. To me, this sounds like an appropriate thing for the military to do. They're testing their equipment, and it sounds like it's got unique capabilities that other surveillance equipment doesn't have. It doesn't make me nervous or unsettled. It sounds like this is perfectly normal and appropriate military activity.
Jacob, thanks. You know, Jacob is basically on the other side there, Arthur, as to the, you know, have to test in order to build your technology.
You know, I have spoken to many people who are involved in the development of these types of technologies, and I can tell you hand on heart that their intentions are in the right place. They have many of the same sort of goals and beliefs that the earlier caller had about the importance of privacy, see. And they want to stop crime, and that's all well and good. But the unfortunate fact is that there is no single powerful surveillance technology throughout history that has not been abused at some point. And so while you can point to specific use cases, potentially including this one, and say that, yes, that is a narrow, constrained, and beneficial use of this technology, the broader question is, could this technology be abused? And are there any measures that we need to take in order to ensure that it isn't abused and so that the beneficial uses can continue unimpeded? And that's a conversation that isn't quite yet happening with this technology, partly because it has been so shrouded in mystery, which leads to a second important part, which is that if a surveillance technology is used in secret without the knowledge of the people who are being watched, there's very little accountability, and it's only in the absence of accountability that we see the really troubling uses emerge and the things that we really do want to block.
So these balloons can carry high-tech radars. Can the technology see through clouds, or what happens in storms?
So one of the benefits of using a radar as opposed to a camera is that it's what's called an all-weather capability. So with a camera, you may not be able to see very well through thick cloud cover. That's obviously not a problem with a radar. If you're looking at a crowd, though, you'd probably prefer to have a telescopic camera that can actually zoom in on individuals and give you identifications of, say, I don't know, whoever you're interested in, say, people who are causing trouble amidst a larger group of peaceful protesters. One of the areas that's being explored is aircraft that have multiple different sensors simultaneously. So say you use the very wide area radar to detect all moving objects in an area, and then you see one object that seems to be particularly suspicious from that sort of broad angle view, and then you use another sensor to get a closer look. Maybe you use one of those telescopic cameras and you can recognize the license plate on the vehicle, say, or you can recognize a person's face. You can tell whether they're doing something nefarious or not. And that's where these technologies become truly capable, because you come to a point where there's no situation where you're sort of blind. You can see in all circumstances.
Talking with Arthur Holland-Michel, co-director of the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College in New York. We're looking at high-altitude military surveillance balloons drifting over parts of Wisconsin. Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about the military launching high-altitude surveillance balloons and what that means for the future of this technology. These new balloons could offer an inexpensive surveillance option that could follow multiple cars and boats for extended periods of time. Upwards of 24 solar-powered balloons are drifting 250 miles, going over parts of our state and landing in central Illinois. How do you think the government should be using surveillance? What restrictions should there be on domestic surveillance? Is this technology okay? What do you want to know about it? Join in with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Arthur Holland-Michel heads up the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College, and he stays with us. Arthur, the article in The Guardian suggested the balloons would carry a system called Gorgon Stare, which you've written a book about. Who developed Gorgon Stare, and what do we know about this type of surveillance?
Sure. So Gorgon Stare actually has a fascinating history, which goes all the way back to the 1998 movie Enemy of the State with Will Smith and Gene Hackman. And in that movie, there's a government agency that uses a fictional spy satellite that's truly incredible, being able to watch Will Smith as he scuttles around Washington, D.C. over broad areas. And that actually inspired a group of engineers within the government to develop a similar capability to actually make something like that into reality. After the CIA got interested in the technology for going after insurgent networks in Iraq and Afghanistan, it was sort of catapulted into the shadowy pantheon of American aerial spycraft. Essentially, what the technology is a giant camera that, as opposed to a single small telescopic camera that can only watch a small area, can watch in some cases, a whole city-sized area, tracking thousands of people and vehicles simultaneously. It has been used extensively in foreign wars, and perhaps troublingly for some, it is now seeing more and more use domestically, particularly for law enforcement operations, using some of those same tactics that were developed by the CIA to go after insurgent groups abroad against people involved in, say, violent crimes or drug trafficking in the United States.
Let's bring in Peter now in Racine. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
What's your question?
I am curious as to who will have access to all this data, all this photogrammetry gathered with this surveillance. Who will have access to all this data that is being collected? I'm really curious about this.
Arthur, where does this data go?
Well, it's a fantastic question. You know, it sort of varies on a case-by-case basis. What we don't have at hand is a policy document from Southern Command or from the company Sierra Nevada Corporation that says exactly what they're going to do with the data, how they're going to process it, how they're going to store it, who they would share it with if the need arises. And so we're operating in a bit of an information vacuum. But the question is a fantastic one, because not only are there concerns about who the data could be shared with, but if the data isn't secured properly, someone could potentially hack into it and then have access to truly detailed information about the state's residents. So that is one of those areas that I think we should be trying to get a little more information about, often because it's more one of the sort of more overlooked technical aspects of surveillance activities, but it's very important nevertheless.
Let's bring in Alejandro in Madison. Hi, Alejandro.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that there's a point where technology starts being abused, and when that's the case, it's too late to stop it. So it's our responsibility now, before it's being abused, if it's not being abused yet, to stop it, because once it crosses that threshold, going back, it's not going to happen, as we have often seen.
So are these surveillance balloons a slippery slope, Arthur?
Well, you could imagine one of these balloons in the wrong hands being used for very nefarious purposes. Now, I can't imagine that happening in the next year or two, say, but Alejandro is right in saying that this is something that is always better to prevent from happening before the fact than having to address after the cat is out of the bag. And I think that's why it's fortunate that we're having this conversation now while the technology is still emerging, as opposed to, say, 10 years from now, when every American city is watched over by a technology like this with very little control as to how it is used and abused. And crucially, some level of action is necessary, and I think everyone will agree to that, even the people who manufacture this technology, because as we heard earlier in the interview, it's all legal right now, and there are very few people who agree that it actually should be completely legal without any checks or balances. So I think the sort of stage is set for a level of change to happen before it's too late.
Sammy now in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Sammy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, as an engineer that avoided working in the defense industry, I thought it was just kind of interesting. The original drones, when they started developing them, people thought they would just be used for surveillance. And then one day their payload, you know, came as a weapon. It's a kind of just a cautionary tale. Could these balloons be weaponized in the future?
Oh, so Sammy is drawing parallels to what we saw in drones. Arthur, do you see parallels?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a story as old as engineering itself, that you create something with a very narrow, constrained, and noble purpose in mind, but now that the technology exists, it can be iterated upon in all sorts of ways that you have no control over. The caller is absolutely right that the drone was initially unarmed. Interestingly, though, it wasn't long after the emergence of the technology that people started trying to figure out how to put missiles upon it. I have heard some talk about how these wide area surveillance aircraft, not the balloons specifically, but aircraft that carry the same payloads, could potentially be weaponized. It's a little hard to look into the crystal ball, but it speaks to a broader point, I think, which is that is there some responsibility on the part of the engineers who create this technology to think about contingencies like that, to think beyond the narrow constrained uses that they have in mind and what the broader implications might be? A lot of the engineers who develop this technology who I've spoken to are starting to grapple with those questions now, because they're seeing that the technology does perhaps have a dark side, and we have to be realistic about that fact.
Let's take time for one more here. Patrick in Madison. Go ahead, Patrick.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. Nice topic. First of all, I saw these balloons when we were camping in Ohio on, I think it was June 20th, near College Corner, Ohio. There were two of them up in the air, and they just stayed in the same spot for more than 12 hours. It was pretty amazing to watch. But my initial call was in response to one of the previous callers who said, you know, was talking about a right to privacy, but we don't have a right to privacy in this country. We never have. I mean, I was under the illusion that we did have a right to privacy too, but we don't.
And because, Patrick, we're running out of time here, Arthur, what might have he seen hovering there in Ohio?
It's hard to tell. I mean, there's been growing investment in these tethered aerostats, as they're called. The military has been using them for well over a decade. What's interesting about the story is that you try and imagine that, say, hovering over a city. That could potentially have a really profound chilling effect on people, where they may not exercise their rights because they're worried that they are being watched. I also might push back on the point that we have no privacy anymore. I think that we actually do have a great deal of privacy. And the fact that a lot of our privacy has admittedly been eroded by things like, you know, internet, big data collection, CCTV cameras, aerial surveillance, means that there's all the more reason to protect the privacy that we have left. And one of those pieces of privacy that still remains is our right to travel through space on roads, say, or sidewalks over extended periods without being watched the entire way, something called persistent surveillance. At the moment, we're not watched in that way, and that means we have privacy if we go from one place to another. But this technology could really threaten that little privacy that we have left.
Arthur, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Arthur Holland Michel is co-director of the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College in New York. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.